Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Gloria, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gloria.
This is going 7 miles beyond any length. I don't know about you, but yeah, I'm from Los Angeles area, El Monte, California. My home group is Los Amigos in Montebello, and I have a woman's home group. I have two, the 502-630 as Bill sees it meeting, and the women's meeting on Thursday night at Miracle House. The book talks about it in A Vision for You, and my husband always says it. You know, great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is I won't say the word, but this is this is a blessing, you know. When I was asked to share, I almost fell flat on my face, you know. I couldn't believe it. I said, what? You know, and I'm really grateful. I want to thank the committee, you know, for allowing me to be here today and going to any lengths, you know. When I first got sober, I didn't want to go to any lengths. I didn't want you, God, or anybody else. You know, I fought this program. See, I'm a Native American, and my given name is Morning Glory Marie. And I hated that name before I got sober. You know, and today, you know, I love that name. You know, I'm an American. I'm an American. And, you know, last night we went to eat at the Cracker Barrel. You ever go there? It's delicious. And, and I was walking around and I saw this blouse and I thought, you know, I never do this. I'm not the kind of person that will dress up for, you know, for an occasion like this. And I thought, you know, it's the 4th of July. Why not? Even the earrings and the necklace, you know, I went all out. And my husband's going like this, you know, when I got there, you know. And, you know, I want to also, before I get into my story, you know, I want to thank the people that came to support me, you know. I flew here, we flew in yesterday with my husband and my two of my sponsees. One of them I sponsored since 1985, and the other one I sponsored for the last 4 years, and she's 23 years sober. And, you know, my sobriety date is May the 2nd of 1982, and I don't say that to impress anybody. I say it because it impresses the heck out of me. You know? I'm the kind of drunk, I don't know about you, but I'm the kind of drunk that used to go to any lengths to get drunk. You know, I used to chase my drinking and doing crazy things. I used to wake up in strange places doing strange things and looking at a lot of strange people. You know, and always wondering how I got there. And how I got there, I went to any lengths to do it. You know, I haven't, well, I've shared it before, but, you know, I used to come to, I don't know about you, I used to come to in motels and wonder how I got there. You know, and then kind of get a glimpse of, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning in LA, you know, you wonder, you know, who's going to be your victim tonight? You know, and I look around the room, and the one that looked the best was probably the, well, I was too drunk, so whether they look good or not, maybe in the mirror they look good, I don't know, from a distance. I'd come two in the morning, and I'd wonder, you know, and I'd look around and wonder how I got there, and I'd look in the bed next to me, I'm going, the person next to me in bed, and I'd lift the covers to see if it was good looking or not, you know? And if it was good looking, I would uncover it. And if it wasn't good looking, I would cover him back up, you know? And that's what I did. And sometimes I came to with the blankets over my head, so it works both ways. It works both ways, you know? I used to wear eyelashes that came out to here, you know? Living in L.A., you learn to do all those things, you know, wear long eyelashes. I wore triple pairs of lashes and, you know, and they always walked in before I did. And if I batted them enough, I would get a drink, you know. And that's, you know, And those last 5 years of my drinking were horrendous. They were the worst 5 years of my life, I think. You know, try to do that. You know, like I said, I'm a Native American, and I was married for 12 years. Right out of prison, I got married. And, you know, one institution into another. And I married an alcoholic. I didn't know he was alcoholic. He didn't know I was alcoholic. And you know, we had these four little boys. And in our 12th year of marriage, you know, he came home for the last time. And I used to say I was an abused wife. But I never told you why I was abused, you know. Never told you the kind of names I called him, you know, to make him angry enough to beat the heck out of me. You know, because I couldn't beat the heck out of him. I got even at night. Apaches attack at night. And that's exactly what I did. You know, I attacked him at night with a broom, you know, and I would get my share of beating him, you know. And he'd wake up in the morning and come into the kitchen and say, you know, I feel like I've been run over by a tractor. Yeah. Got blood oozing all over the place. And you know, and I did countless times I did that, you know, because I couldn't get my fist on him. And, anyway, in the 12th year of our marriage, you know, he came home for the last time and we got into it for the last time and he beat me so bad, sent me to the hospital for the last time and I knew he was gonna kill me one day or, you know. And what happened is that, I came out of the hospital and I had my brother help me get a divorce. See, I didn't know I had choices. I didn't know I had choices. And what happened, to make a long story short, I left the hospital and I was staying with my brother until I got rehabilitated a little bit because I couldn't walk. The kids and I moved back into the house on December the 4th of 1975 and we made plans for Christmas and New Year's and, you know, we made plans for ourselves, just the five of us. And what happened is that night when I put my children to bed, I kissed them goodnight and I told them that I loved them and it was it was okay for me. And I did what I did every day. I drank, you know, I got my bottle and I drank a fifth of whiskey. I'm a whiskey drinker, you know, and I went to bed and in the middle of the night, in the early part of the morning, I was awakened, but I couldn't open my eyes and I could smell smoke and I could hear the fire engines. And, you know, to make a long story short, I lost my four boys in that fire. And I don't tell you that to feel sorry for me. The last 5 years of my drinking and waking up and doing ugly things, you know, I did enough to last me a lifetime. When anybody told me, why do you drink the way you drink? Why do you do the things that you do? I'd tell them, if you lost your kids, you'd drink too. And before you know it, I had lots of drinks on me right here, you know. Today I don't have to do that. Today I don't use my kids as an excuse to drink or to do anything that I shouldn't do. You know, my recovery is based on the legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, going to any lengths, you know, doing the things that normally I wouldn't have done. My poor sponsor, I threw the big book at her, you know, a lot of times, because I wasn't willing to go to any lengths. I wasn't willing to take the steps. I wasn't willing. I got sober in Burbank, of all places in L.A., you know, and there were a bunch of dinosaurs. You know, they all had white hair, you know, and today I don't have white hair because I diet, of course. You know? I don't want to be called a dinosaur. I'm 69 years old, and you know, by all rights, my hair should be white, and it is, but under all that. And, you know, and the legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous are what has kept me sober, what has kept me going, you know, sponsoring women, being of service, going when I don't want to go. You know, going to any lengths for me means also trusting in God. You know, meditation today was really good. I can't remember it now. I forgot it. So, you know, my mind is a mind of a 69-year-old and it goes and it comes whenever it wants. And, you know, but, you know, I've been married to my husband for 26 years, but we lived in sin for four. So that makes it 30. And you know, he shares his kids with me. You know, I have three. stepchildren, a daughter and two sons. And his son is in the Navy. He's been in the Navy for over 30 years. And I guess he's a lieutenant commander now. And by all rights, I shouldn't be anywhere with their children because, you know, I never wanted to be around children. And because of you and the God that I found here, you know, my husband who lit the house that burnt my house, you know, that killed our kids, I used to bash him all the time from the podium. I used to bash him back and forth, you know, cuss him out from the podium. And one day this lady with a heavy accent, she was from the Radford group. She was, I guess, from Alabama. Oh, that was her name, Alabama. Sorry for dropping a name. I don't like to do that. And anyway, she was my grand sponsor, and she went like this to me, and she told me, "How dare you bash your ex-husband for what he did, you know? He was an alcoholic just like you." And I didn't understand that in the beginning. I said, but he killed my kids, you know? And I didn't understand that. And I believe with all my heart that somewhere along the way, I found forgiveness, you know, and I have a little spot for him here, you know, a little spot for him here. My sponsor died when I was 5 years sober, and I have a spot for her here. My mother, the same thing, you know, I forgave my mother for what I thought she couldn't be, you know, for what I wanted her to be, and all I know today is that she did the best that she could. You know, you taught me that. Today when I go to any lengths, it's not just going to the market or to a meeting or, you know, I go to any lengths inside of my heart also. You know, because that's where God dwells for me. He dwells inside, you know, and he works through you to touch me. You know, if I can stay sober, you know, in spite of what I've been through, you know, even in sobriety, you know, I'm not perfect. You can ask my husband. He'll be the first one to tell you I'm not perfect. You know, I drove 19 years without a driver's license. Sober. Sober. I didn't realize at the time that I was endangering the women that I was taking to meetings, you know, in my car. But, you know, anything in the dark like that comes out into the light. You know, and I had to take care of it. And it only took me two weeks to get my license and to be legitimate. But, you know, I don't do it. You know, don't do it. It's a felony to drive without a license for that long. And I figured I was old. I didn't need to. I drive good. I hadn't gotten a ticket. But I did. And you know, God is good. I found God in rooms like you, in rooms like this. You know, I have a sponsor. She has a sponsor, you know, and I was hoping she'd be here, but she's not. And I've had beautiful sponsors, you know, and I have sobriety sisters that are here to support me, you know, which is really wonderful. I have another sponsee right here from Portland, Oregon, you know, that I met at a women's conference. And you know, we've been together ever since via phone, via email, whatever it takes. And that's going to any lengths as well. You know, I want to welcome anyone who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are new here, you know, and I want to thank the old timers for staying, you know, because without them, we wouldn't be here. You know, my husband has 38 years of sobriety and he never lets me forget it. Never lets me forget it. You know, and he always, when he wants a cup of coffee, he'll say, "How much time do you have?" You know? But, you know, I live a good life, you know. I love my husband like I loved him when I first met him, when I first saw him, when I was first with him. You know, I love him just the same. He's my friend. There's a lot of times that I don't like him, you know, and he knows it. But I tell him, "I don't like you today," and it's all right, you know. Because I've been taught not to be a moral coward, you know. And being a moral coward means, you know, not keeping your mouth shut and stuffing it. And I don't do that. I go to any lengths to stay sober. I'll tell you the truth, you know, if it's going to help you. I won't lie to you so you can be my friend, you know, because if I lie to you just so you can be my friend, then I'm not doing any justice, you know, to anyone. You know, I want to thank these, Terry and Bob, for being up here with me. You know, I was nervous and You know, and I'm so glad just to be here. You know, what an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you, Gloria. So I had a reminder as Gloria was talking about this going to any lengths. And I was thinking about it when you were talking about the forgiveness work with your former husband. And one of those big ones for me was at 15 years sober, realizing the only way I could make the amend to my daughters that was due after emotionally abusing them in sobriety was to divorce their mom. It was the only way things could be made right. And I just met with my daughter last night for dinner, and she said again, thank God, because now we have our mom and our dad, and it was absolutely the right thing to do. And yet I remember being petrified of having to stand in a meeting at 15 years sober and say, I've got a really hard decision I've got to make, and it feels like I'm a failure. But in fact, it was absolutely the right thing to do, and it took that moral courage thing you were just talking about, Gloria. So thanks for the very, very powerful reminder for me. So next up, and I'd like you to outdo yourselves on the applause this time for Terry, who came all the way from Billings, Montana. Terry?
Thought for sure he was talking about Bob. Hi, my name's Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. Because of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a woman like me has not had to take a drink since January 28, 1987. My home group is a recovery group in Billings, Montana, and one of my peeps. My sponsor is Donna H., and I just thank God for those things on a daily basis. I was sitting up here thinking of Bill W., pacing the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, lonely, thinking of scraping up a companion, and I look at us. You know, what has happened in these 80 years from a lonely alcoholic with no solution to the fellowship that we have today, and the solution I've heard this weekend has been incredible. I am blessed. So I would say that my whole sobriety has been a practice of holding my hand open so God could put in and take out what he saw fit. That it's been all about letting go, you know, of my ideas of what I think I need, what I think you need. And it has been in holding on to things that has caused me pain and growth and all of that stuff. I am, when I got to AA, it was like, come on in, you know, and then they tell you stuff like you gotta, believe and trust and surrender. Believe in a God you can't see. Trust people you don't know. Surrender to a process. That's not where I come from. You know, you don't trust anybody. You know, certainly don't believe in God, and you do not surrender. You die fighting. That is the code. But I got to tell you, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was tired. I was tired, you know, and I got here just begging you guys to tell me what to do. I did not know how to do sober. I did not know how to do sobriety. And I am so grateful today for the gift of desperation that pushed me through the door and made me willing to go to the lengths you guys asked me to do. And I certainly haven't done it perfectly or all the time, but for some reason I've been able to be honest with my sponsor about I'm not willing to do that. I don't feel like I can do that, you know. So I don't want to stand up here and make it sound like I've been perfect about going to any length. But I did learn early in sobriety that you can only coast with downhill momentum, which means you're already on your way out, you know. I've paid attention to those kind of lessons, and I've had a good sponsorship. I'm one of those people who didn't work the steps when I got here. I got a sponsor who was very much into service work. I mean, I'd been to 6 area assemblies before I worked the steps, you know, and we have a past delegate named Mary Ann, and she said, service kept me sober till I could find recovery, and that was my experience. And God put a woman in my life when I thought AA, when I thought I'd done AA and it didn't work. And she was a hardcore sponsor. She didn't care much about how I felt. She just cared about what I was willing to do. And by the time she showed up in my life, I was willing to do anything, you know. And I think of some of the things. I think the first demonstration in my recovery that I was willing to go to any length is I lived with a man. We had a infant baby. My son was 4 months old when I got sober. And he'd always been telling me, man, if you didn't drink, I'd marry you. So when I got sober, I had this idea I was holding on to, you know, that we would get married and live happily ever after. When I was about 3 months sober, something that I'd done in my past caught up with me, and it was overwhelming me. And I lived in a house where we still had all the dope under the coffee table, the beer in the fridge, and bottles on top of the fridge. And I knew that night I couldn't sleep, and I knew that, man, just one, and I'll be able to go to sleep. And I got in my car, and I went to my sister's house, and the next day I came back, and I said, man, I'm not going to be able to stay with you if you don't quit drinking. And he said, you have no right to give me ultimatums. I said, I'm not. I said, I'm just making decisions about my life. And at that time, I made the decision to stay sober, and I left him, and I let go of that idea that he and I and our kid were going to live happily ever after. And I remember thinking, okay, God, if you really are, here I come. And I think that really the momentum, again, every time I've had to make those decisions to let go of the things I needed in my life, or the people I've needed in my life, or it just opens up my world bigger and bigger and bigger. I am not somebody who ever drank without consequence. And believe me, for a long time, it was worth everything it cost. I was willing to pay any price. And it turns out when I got sober that it was going to cost me something too. You know, it cost me all my old friends. It cost me the pool league, for sure. dancing in the clubs, you know, my old hangouts. And it's not like that. I'm not saying that that's got to be. I'm saying that that's what it had to be for me. I had to be willing to turn my back and walk away from all of that. And I was willing at that time to do that. My sobriety has cost me upward mobility in my career, because I knew for me to stay sober, I needed to be going to meetings. I needed to be sponsoring other people. I needed to be doing service and corrections and service at my district and area and all those things. I had to be participating in all three legacies, and I watched people taking jobs that took them out of AA. They couldn't participate in the level that they had been before. And I chose to stay where I was in my position. And the good news is about that is I stayed there year after year after year after year. And for somebody who got fired twice from that job, last year I retired after 34 and a half years of service to the post office. And I was a mailman, and I run into people all the time in that career staying right where I was. I delivered their packages when they had their new baby. I delivered the birthday presents as their kids grew up. I delivered those graduation presents. And then I delivered the presents for when those babies had their babies. I mean, it was just this incredible thing. And, one time I stopped at this mailbox, and there was a letter in there, and it said, "Dear Terry, we lost Jazzy last night, but I want you to know that you were the highlight of her life." And it was their dog. And the strangest thing, well, this is how it works, is their, this was in the country, and their mailbox was where I didn't even think you could see it. And, I mean, I gave Jazzy treats for probably 12 years, and eventually Jazzy got too old to even get up. But she'd be out there beside the mailbox, and I'd get out, and I'd give her a treat because she couldn't get up. The thing is I didn't even know they ever saw me. And when I pulled that note out of the mailbox, I got it. People are watching me. People see me that I don't even know about. I am an example, good or bad, whatever I'm doing. And I've gotten some spiritual lessons in this program that I cannot even describe. This, when I was talking about Bill pacing the Mayflower Hotel, I identify with that kind of loneliness. And today I look around me, I have friends that couldn't get in and they were angry, almost ready to start a fist fight. People that love and care about me. You know, I think of my mother. I was such a constant source of disappointment for my mother. And she is so proud of me. What's bigger is I'm so proud of me. I'm a woman I can be proud of. I'm a woman of integrity. I'm a woman who can say yes and then do it. And that was not the way before I got here. Even though I wanted to be, I could not be that person. And over the years, I have been willing to go to any length to take me closer or further down the road of sobriety. I think that every action I take takes me one of two places, further down the road of recovery or closer to my next drink. And I want to stay on this road of sobriety. I have, there was a woman, I've always been somebody who has been trying to belong somewhere, someplace. And when I moved from Virginia Beach, Virginia to Billings, Montana, there was a girl in the, I think it was in the seventh grade, who was my best friend. She made herself my best friend. And I was so grateful for her. We bought horses. We did all kinds of stuff. But by the eighth grade, there was like this little gang, the cool people. And I needed to be there. I needed to belong to them. And I treated her so poorly, you know, because I'm the person, I'm a bad breaker-upper. But I can make it so bad for you, you want to break up with me. So, not my fault, you know. But I mean, I treated her so poorly, pushed her down the stairs, got in fist fights, made her life so miserable, she literally switched schools in the eighth grade. You know, I pretended that didn't matter to me because I ended up in this gang it would have been if Billings, Montana had gangs in 1972. And, but when I got sober and I got ready to make that amends with my sponsor, I told her, I have not seen her for 19 years. I don't need to write this letter. I don't need to prepare. I'm never going to see this woman. And my sponsor said, you write out the letter as if you're going to see her. And I wrote that letter. And the next Saturday, I was at a wedding and I was going through the reception line and she was right in front of me. And I thought, okay, now's not the time, right? We'll wait till we get to the church, to the party, right? That was it. But I was going to do it. But I got to the wedding reception itself and she wasn't there. Why would she be? You know, she saw me. Why? She was getting out of there. She had no idea. So the next day, I'm at an AA meeting, and I'm sitting at a coffee table, and I'm telling somebody about that. And I said her name, and this lady sitting on the couch said, that's my best friend. And she set me up to make amends with that woman. And do you know, when I got to that woman's house, this is what I thought. I haven't seen her for 19 years. She hasn't given it a thought. You know, it was in the eighth grade. But I got to her house and I told her, I said, it had nothing to do with you. It was my selfish, self-centered need to be bigger, better, more. You were the best friend anybody could have had, she said, for 19 years. I've wondered what I did wrong. But I look at if I'm showing up and willing to go to any length, even though I never even thought I'd see her again, God sets it up. You know, God's what's making it happen. And I got to sit in that living room 19 years later and tell her, no, you didn't do anything, you know. And those are the kind of things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous as I've shown up one day at a time, willing to go to any length. And, you know, I am not the one who's gotten to decide what any length is. I've given my sponsor permission to tell me what my any length is going to be. I'm pretty sure if I was picking any length that I'd have never got to have that spiritual experience with that woman. But better than that, that woman would have never gotten the freedom from that if I had not been willing to show up and write that letter. Alcoholics Anonymous has been a journey of willing to go to any length. And I think the longer I'm sober, the harder it gets. It's the harder it gets to stay powerless, the harder it gets to think, to stay with the, I don't know what I need, I don't know what you need. And, but it's still always going to be a practice of holding everything with an open hand to let God put in and take out what he sees fit. It's always going to be about that. It's always going to be willing to go to any length, going to meetings, giving people rides, I know people that step aside as they get more sobriety for the newcomer. I am not willing to step aside. I'm willing to take them with me. But there was a guy at my meeting Monday night, and his name is Kevin. And he has been in and out of prison for 30 years. And Monday night, he stood at the podium, and he said, I want to get this thing. I just want to feel like a real person. And I identified with that. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just wanted to be like a real person. But if I wasn't at that meeting, if I wasn't working with newcomers, I would forget what it felt like to not feel like a real person. I would forget what it felt like to wake up sick and ashamed day after day after day. So I still, no matter how long I am, I will never be so sober that I don't need to go to meetings, that I don't need to work with newcomers, that I don't need to be a service to others. I don't think that I will ever get that sober. I'm not someone who believes that meetings and sponsors and the 12 steps keep me sober. I believe that God keeps me sober. But the meetings, the working with others, the 12 steps, the meeting with sponsor, the being service is what creates the environment for me to access the power of God. So I need it all. And I hope, I pray to God that I never forget that. Thank you.
Excellent, Terry. So I'm getting this opportunity to do 10th step work up here for those of you noticing me writing stuff down. And in the spirit of the 10th step, I'm going to tell you what I just, what came up, which is one of the hardest things in recovery for me was even worse than admitting to that divorce I need to have and the emotional abuse of my kids was at 17 years sober having to admit that something wasn't right despite working a good program. It had to do with yet one more broken relationship, and someone in a meeting said, oh, but you know, Bill's got 7 ex-wives. You're good to go, man. And I knew something wasn't right, so I called my sponsor, and I said, man, I have got to go off and do that inpatient treatment you suggested I do. And he said, well, you wouldn't want to rush these decisions, Ron, because it had been 10 years. He'd been telling me I had inpatient work to do. And what it was, and I'm going to tell you because my hands are shaking because it seems so unmanly to admit that at 17 years sober, my going to any lengths required work with codependency and love addiction. which was like just interlocked with my alcoholism. And when you pulled the booze away, I'm left with having to deal with a bunch of messy relational stuff. And even today, the feeling of exposure, of admitting you can work a good program and still have to go to any lengths in ways. And somebody asked me once when I was sharing this sort of stuff, said, well, don't you think this is a bad message for the newcomers? And I said, no, because there are people in here with 15 years sober who need to know that it's okay to go get professional help when you got time and steps and sponsees and a life that works. That is a huge, powerful message, I think, for all of us, because then when you have difficulties, if you're relatively young in sobriety, you'll go, oh, I remember that guy saying that he had to go do that. Maybe it's okay for me. And by the way, last point before we go on to Bob, because my sponsor, who's been working with me for 25 years, says the one page he has seen most consistently discarded from the big book is 133, where it says we should seek professional help if we need it. And I am that guy. I needed that professional help desperately. So thank you for stirring those feelings up, Terry. I'm going to have to call my sponsor after this meeting. So now, from South River, New Jersey, we got Bob Please. Big applause.
Well, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bob. I'm the oldest guy up here, but I got the least sobriety. My sobriety date is 2/21/01. My sponsor is Herc K., a man with 30-some years. I can't say ex-Marine, disabled Marine. And my home group is Olbers Sunday Night, right here in Olbers, New Jersey. And I got to say, we got a bunch of guys here from sort of a second home group that I go to in Atlantic City where we have our casinos. The young people's group is back there, so it's good to see those guys. It's nice. I go there enough that they tell me don't introduce yourself as a visitor. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but it is what it is. I asked my sponsor before I got, what am I going to say here? I'm the guy who got, I didn't get DUIs. I get in trouble with the law. I didn't lose my job. I didn't lose my family. My wife and I are married 47 plus years. I started very late as an alcoholic. So what do I tell people about going to any lengths? He says, why don't you tell them the story I told him? Now, he was a Marine in Beirut, Lebanon, when the barracks were destroyed and 200-plus Marines were killed. Maybe some of you remember that terrible thing. And he was sober at the time, and a bunch of other guys. Their story actually made it into the grapevine a year or two ago. And he tells me, guys used to sit in a bomb hole from the shelling that the New Jersey was doing. On the enemy, there were bomb holes near the barracks, and they would brew coffee in a steel pot, put the coffee in a sock, and get some hot water, and that would be their coffee, and they would have a meeting in there. That's going to any lengths. The bombs are flying, the enemy shooting at you, that's going to any lengths. To me, if you want to stay sober, you can stay sober. I'm from northern New Jersey, Area 44. And we have over 1,400 meetings a week. So if your crummy excuse is I can't find the meeting, go talk to somebody else. I'm not listening to you. You know, you can make a meeting almost any time in a day. I've been to places. We were in Rapid City, South Dakota a few years ago to go see the monuments and all that. I mean, there were gentlemen who are not New Jersey cowboys, real cowboys, you know, the dirty. These guys have been riding the range all day long. They're coming in beat up trucks. They're dirty. They're sweaty. They're coming to meetings. They've gone a long way to come to a meeting. That's going to any lengths to stay sober. I got to tell you, though, I walked in with a nice shirt and a nice pair of shorts, real looking. I just barely got into the door of the clubhouse, and the guy says, "You're not from here." So, but you know, I was just one of them. I'm just another drunk, just like I am, and that's the joy of this fellowship. We're just all drunks wherever we go. There's people, my wife and I are now like on a 14-day trip from Jersey down here. We're going to go to Savannah and Charleston and Fredericksburg. And it's all nice. And I try to make meetings when I can because I love going to local meetings. I love to hear what other people say. And plus it helps me stay sober. Let me just give you a real quick synopsis of my story. I had a very normal life. My parents were just nice people. They're total blue-collar workers. My mother was, she worked in a sweatshop, they were called back. The stuff they do in Thailand now for pennies apiece, well, in our part of New Jersey, that's where the work was sent from New York. My father was a sheet metal worker, tin knocker to you guys in the trades. And he was a hard-working man. He built cabinets on his, on the weekends to make money. He had a polka band when polka bands were in. And it's a long time ago, you know. You got to keep in mind, I live in a town, now please nobody get offended, but on the south side of the track was the Russian Alley. On the north side was the Polish, the Polak section, how we called it back then. And it wasn't offensive, that's just what we called each other. And then there was for the Hungarians, the Hunky section over off Gorhoviak Street. And that was the real world. It wasn't meant as racist or anything, it's just who we were. You didn't cross the broad, you know, the Russians didn't date the Polish people. There are different churches and all that. Oh, boy, bad stuff. But it was a simple life. I grew up in the church with my parents. We went to church. We earned money. We didn't have a whole lot of money. I was very fortunate. I graduated high school in 62. And so it's a long time ago. And I got accepted into Rutgers University. None of you Big Ten guys boo. But the point is, back then, it cost us $200 a semester to go to college. You might be spending a little more these days on that event. And the point is, it was still hard to make money. We had to pay for it. My folks had to pay for it. I eventually, with some guys in high school, we started a band. We had a polka band tonight, a rock band tonight, an Italian band tonight. We had no aspirations of going anywhere. All we wanted to do was make enough money to get to college and get ourselves some job. We couldn't afford to join fraternities or any of this fancy stuff, you know. That's how life was. And there's nothing wrong with that. It was just wonderful. My father never drank a drop in his life that I know of. My mother was just like my wife is, an earth drinker. Give her one drink, she'll be okay, maybe. Give her two drinks, get out of the way. She's dizzy and falling down. That's not what most of us in here have experienced over life. I've been married, like I said, over 47 years. Well, we've gone through illnesses. Our parents are all passed on. We've had things happen in life and all that. I've never heard my wife say one time in her life, I need a drink. Now, there's something very different about her mind, her chemistry, her genetics than is in my mind and genetics. I got through college, like I said, I got drafted. Uncle Sam asked me to join his army in 1967. His Christmas gift to me, by the way, was my draft notice was on Christmas Eve. I thought that was rather crude, but I had nobody to complain to. So I visited his army for 2 years. I was a fortunate, there were 667 of us medics who got trained in San Antonio. And, seven of us didn't go to Vietnam. I was one of those seven. I don't know what the, you know, you mathematicians can do to work on that, but that's pretty long odds. And, I had already been engaged to my wife. Another little quick aside, just how simple our life was. I met my wife in church singing in a choir. We still sing in a choir. And she delivered eggs to my house. And as the eggs got bigger, the relationship got more serious, the eggs got bigger. Once we started getting double yolkers, time for an engagement ring. It was a pretty simple deal, you know, but that's how life was. We got out of the army. I never joined the EM club. I made some rank and all that kind of stuff. But we went. I had a job as a chemist in a pharmaceutical company. My wife had graduated in nursing school, so she was getting off to a job in nursing. And we went on with life. We learned to sail a boat. We got pretty good at it. We won some races and blah, blah, blah. And eventually we decided to have a son. And again, not just social drinking. I built the wine rack because I really like Bordeaux and all that kind of stuff. And we drank them socially. Only one. And we used to buy a bottle of Bordeaux or two and store it for 10 years till it became good. But interesting enough, the wine rack I built after, in hindsight, was 99 bottles. Now, I know a lot of us, older people sang that all the time on the school buses and whatnot. So there's something symbolic there. I don't want to go into that. I even laugh at that today. But life was simple. We had a son, and we only had the one because he never knew the word sleep. He just was awake all the time. At least that's my conception of it. My wife may tell you a different story, but don't ask her. But anyway, and he turned out to be this perfect kid. He was a really good student. He learned when computers were just starting out, when you just had Apple II pluses for you really old timer and stuff. Well, he learned to build computers at 13 years old. We had to incorporate him because he was building custom made computers and writing programs for organizations, for restaurants, for a hospital. He did one and he ended up valedictorian at his high school. And I only say this because there's not a darn thing back there that says, I'm a drunk because. I became drunk because I'm an alcoholic. That's what it says to me. And life went on grand. We did all the things that people do. You travel, you visit, you socialize, and we kept singing in a church and all that kind of stuff. But then somewhere around 44, 45 years old, I have no idea why, I got the brilliant idea that a drink after work would be a good idea. Then a drink before dinner. Then a drink with dinner. And a drink after dinner. And now you all know this is the progression you went through at some point in your life. Be it at 8 years old, 12 years old, 13 years old, it happened to me. And it came on with a vengeance. And if you tell me, to me, when I was 49 or 50, and I can't give you dates, I never know how people say, I got sober on 315. What, are you kidding me? I didn't know what 315 was. But when I'm 49 or 50 years old, I'm saying to myself, I have to stop after. And you pick a date, birthday, Christmas, 4th of July, pick some. I could not stop. I would have become a 24/7 drinker. I was a home drinker. I hate bars to this day. I don't know what it is about bars. That didn't stop me from drinking. I was hiding bottles all over the house. We have a house that has hot air and air conditioning. So I loved the winter and the summer because the fans would make a lot of noise. So it was easy to sneak around the house and sneak a drink while my wife was there. The spring and fall, when it's nice, you got open windows. It's hard to drink when you're trying to sneak drinks, you know. This is work. It's amazing how much work went into alcoholism. It's exhausting to me. It's crazy. Now, I got to tell you, when I was at Rutgers, I took a course, a one-year elective course at the School for Alcohol Studies. It was the government center back then, on alcoholism. Didn't do me much good, but I reread the book after I got sober. I did all those things. But the point is, I'm going along, and I'm hiding bottles. I switched from a hard-sided briefcase to go get a soft-sided so I could carry alcohol into my office. I had a private office. You had to knock to come in my office. I just had alcohol in my office. Of course, drinking it out of the foam cup thing, you know. And I started out drinking good scotches. I really liked the good scotches. And I kept saying, wait a minute, I'm drinking too much, I'm kind of cheap. So I started getting the cheaper scotches. Then I heard that wonderful lie, vodka doesn't stink. The great American lie. And so I switched to vodka. And I was, back then, Smirnoff was the good stuff. You know, now we got 8 million vodkas of everything in under the sun. But then I worked my way down, and I don't know what you have around your countries, but we got, part of country, we got Leeds, Popoff, you know, this Majorska. That's how we pronounce it around our way anyway. How you pronounce it might be different. But that's the kind of fine, vodka I was drinking. And why bother with a glass? You know, we know glasses, ice is superfluous. The bottle. I was driving a Corvette at the time, and there's a thing underneath the back window there. You put we would have a spare tire if you had a spare tire, but there wasn't one in the C5s and on because the tires were different. But the point is, that thing would sit in there, be 120, 30 degrees. When I needed a drink, I didn't care. Down the throat it went. That's where alcohol. At the end of my drinking, I'm wearing a suit and tie, got a management position. I got a wife, a family, a kid who's graduated college. He's got a fine job as a computer engineer. And I'm driving a Corvette, and I'm a crummy drunk. I'm a two-bit drunk. That's what I was. I believe my own personal opinion, except for one 5-day stay in a hospital, for various things I believe were related to alcoholism, I couldn't stop drinking. I don't think I had illegal blood alcohol for months, maybe years. And I never knew it because I love this term, functioning alcoholic. That's the most insane term I ever heard. Why? Because I'm drinking half a liter of alcohol a day and I'm functioning. What kind of functioning is that, you know? Something's missing in the definition of functioning. So anyway, I'm 56 years old. I'm running a large project with a lot of money involved. It was an FDA mandated project. I worked for a pharmaceutical company. We had to convert data and all that. It's good stuff was going on. But I had my morning drink and all that. I'm not being threatened by my job, my wife, or anybody else. And I just decided I got to do something about my drinking. So I picked up, left my office, drove home drunk, of course. But when I got home, I started shaking, freezing, vibrating, I'm all covered up. I covered myself up. I'm laying in a ball. I called my wife and I says, I got to do something about my drinking. Not alcoholism, something about my drinking. And she came home from work. She was a public health nurse. We're both nothing now. We're just retired, living life, enjoying it with people. Well, we're not nothing. Yeah. That sounds wrong, doesn't it? I got to find a better way. It's bad when your wife's sitting right down here. But I never want to forget the look on my wife's face. I don't know. Now, she's a nurse. She's seen a lot of bad things in her life, as you can well imagine. But out of fear, hate, disgust, you piece of garbage, what do I do with you now? To me, no human being should ever make another human being feel like that. Because I just felt so bad. And then I started telling her to where I hid all the bottles. She was rather shocked about the one in the briefcase. And we found some bottles many years later in the Christmas decorations. I don't even remember. They could have come invaluable when I was running up. But that was life. And I so little trusted myself. I told her to take the car keys, the credit cards, my wallet, and I just didn't try. I'm 56 years old. I'm like a middle nothing in a big corporation, but some responsibility. And I don't trust myself not to drink. That's crazy, man. That's what alcohol did to me. In those last few months, I didn't care if I lived or died. I wasn't going to commit suicide, but I didn't give a flying hoot if I died or not. It was accepted. That was life. That's sad to get to that point in life. That's really sad. And that's where life took me. We started the process. My wife called the EAP for me. Our parish priest was new to our parish. We're both Russian, so we go to this Russian church thing. And you'll love this one. We've got an Irishman as a priest in a Russian church. So figure that one out, folks. 5 minutes. I got to go here. But, geez, I'm sorry, guys. But anyway, I got into Carrier. I did 5 days in Carrier. I don't remember much. You know, they used to use the term mocus. Well, I was mocus. I couldn't retain anything. But at that point I came up with the idea. It was sort of like diabetes. You know, I got it later in life. Some people get born with it, middle. So it works for me. And I've got what I've got. Today, I started going to meetings. I didn't like them, but that was me. That wasn't the meetings. I did the IOP thing. And all that good stuff. I got to say, my wife went every Monday to IOP. It was family night. And I didn't want to go to AA, but the Dr. Pfeiffer who ran it, he didn't identify himself as an alcoholic. She made me go, took me to a couple of AA meetings. And you got to keep in mind, my wife was a nurse and a farm girl, so she could use heavy equipment and very sharp instruments. So put those two together. But anyway, I eventually got this program. I figured out AA's the only place for me. About 5 months into sobriety, I heard somebody say, I want to go back to who I was 20 years ago. One of those magic moments in AA. 20 years ago, I was an alcoholic in training. I got to do something about that. How do I do it? The steps. I'd been going to a step meeting and not having the slightest clue about it. I did the steps. I did them with vengeance, but it took me about a year and a half into sobriety that I finally finished them. I did them the best I could. I don't believe in it. You got to do them perfect stuff. You do the best you can. That's what you do. You do the best you can because it's all about staying sober. I try to make a meeting every day if I can. I'm retired, so it's not that hard. I've got a group of friends. We enjoy each other's company. I got a friend who's up in Maine visiting now for the summer. He always says it's all about doing the drill. And he's an ex-military guy. I was in the military. That doing the drill is important. There's a drill to this program. There's a They're saying prayers in the morning. I read the daily reflections in the morning. I happen to read the Bible in the morning. There's prayers at night. There's that 10th step. I don't care how dog tired I am. I'm doing a 10th step at night because that's telling me which way I'm going. I learned from the old timers. You're either going forward or you're going backwards. Well, we all know where backwards go. We had a young man, 27 years old, in our home group. I'm going to say month and a half ago, he died from an overdose because he couldn't get this program. This program doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care where you came from. It's out to kill you. It's for me to hold it in abeyance. I think that's kind of the best I can do. But we live a good life today. We do anything we want to do. We like food. We travel. We do stuff. And really, the only restriction I find that I have in life is not take alcohol one day at a time. That's it. I can drink anything else. When we ask my wife, what do we tell somebody when we want to drink? She says, why don't you say coffee, tea, juice, soda? Well, we didn't think of that as an alcoholic. You say, it's vodka, whatever it is. So it's life. And let me just finish with this. We both sing in a choir. We're retired. So in our church, it's all a cappella singing. And we go to funeral homes and sing. And we sing at the funeral in church. Many of those people suffered miserably at the end of their lives, young, old, and middle age. They suffered miserably. Just think if all those people were offered the option. Just don't take a drink of alcohol one day at a time, and you would live a good, full life. What else is there? Thank you for allowing me to share.
What is it with drunks from New Jersey and their storytelling? Like, so good. Actually, you reminded me of my friend Nina A. from Norfolk, who talked about going to any lengths. She was celebrating 28 years, and she told her husband that she was going to go off to the regular meeting to celebrate. And he said, honey, there's a hurricane coming. And she said, oh, I know. And he said, well, will there be anybody in there? She goes, oh, yeah, there's always people there. So she goes off into the gale force winds. She comes back an hour and a half later carrying her 28-year chip. Right? And he says, were they really there? And she goes, oh yeah, they brought my chip. They brought a store-bought cake and we talked and now I'm home. Let's close the doors, honey. And, so it's like being willing to go to any lengths. So, I'm told that we have plenty of time. I'm told we can use this time for those of you who might like to come up here and share your experience, strength, and hope. I'm going to put one proviso on it. There's a meeting just outside of Austin, Texas, that has a sign on the wall that says, we know you can share for more than 3 minutes. We can't listen for more than 3 minutes. Which I think is like really good truth in advertising, right? So if someone would like to come up here, and the focus is how you might be practicing going any lengths today, we've got a few minutes for someone who'd like to come up. Everybody's bolting for the coffee shop. Okay. Looks like nope. Oh, come on up. Yep, looks like we got some hands coming up. Come on up. You just got to be willing to put your mouth on a microphone. Yep, upstairs on this side.
I am an alcoholic, and my name is Tess.
Hi, Tess.
And emotion is going to come out. Go to Tenny Lentz. My sobriety date is January 6, 2003. And thank you. But I didn't practice my program up until 2.5 years ago. And that's when I understood what it meant to go to any lengths. And today, what I'm experiencing is out of this world. If you sit on your ass, it's not going to happen. It's there for you. And by the grace of God, I've been allowed the blessing to be aware that drinking wouldn't change anything no matter what happened in my life. So that's why I can say that my sobriety date is still 2003. I got out of myself is what it boils down to. I finally turned my will and my life over to the care of God. That's simple step 3. Holy shit. I mean, that's all it took. And once I did that, then I started reaching out. I could not reach out to people because I was still in control. I prayed to God, but I didn't understand the concept of praying. I knew that, you know, I couldn't continue to drink, but it was like, hey, life is better. You know, look at all these gifts that I'm having. And I was the functioning alcoholic. I announced to everybody, I'm a functioning alcoholic. And I thought that was, I thought it was hilarious, you know, because I wasn't under the bridge. I had the job, you know, I had the soulmate and all that other shit. And you know, a year ago, April, I got divorced, 20-year marriage, you know, and something I shared with someone in the line to get into this meeting, I lost it all 3.5 years ago. But I was finally able to see that what I ended up doing was losing what didn't serve me anymore to bring me to where I am now, because I finally am discovering me, exploring me. And boy, what a beautiful thing. And I still have work to do. I still have work to do. But man, I reached out, and that was so difficult for me to do in the last 2.5 years. To put myself out there and go with the fear of rejection, that you're not going to notice me, you're not going to want to be available to me. Because, I mean, I always felt that I had to do this on my own, even though I kept hearing it. No, this is why we're here. This is why we're a part of a fellowship. You know, we've got God and whatnot. But I just didn't understand. I needed to let go. Because I took care of everything, you know. And finally, after I reached out, you all started taking notice, and I go, hey. And it's like, didn't I see you last night? Didn't I see you last week? And before you know it, here I am 2.5 years later, experiencing awakenings like there's no tomorrow. It's out there. Go to any lens if you really want it. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Cass. Yep, you're next. We'll get to you. Well, maybe. We'll see. Okay?
Hello, my name's Larry, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 4th, 1981. I've been to a whole lot of conferences, conventions. My first one was Montreal, and I can tell you that I love these things. Going to any lengths was, I came into AA, was going to any lengths, because I was not an alcoholic. I didn't need people or a place to go to stop drinking, a simple thing like stopping drinking. I was a violent drunk. I came home a number of times, told my wife I got to do something about this drinking. And the day I finally made the decision and came home and told her I have to do something about this drinking, she didn't pay any attention to me. She kept cooking or whatever, and I put my fist through the closet door, and she called someplace. And I said, you better not be calling the cops. And because that's how I drank, and I was a blackout drinker. And she called this place called the Kelly House. And I went to the Kelly House, and I was scared, and I was bombed, and I wasn't staying. And God gave me a whole lot of inspiration and messages. At the time, I didn't know there were messages from God, but there was a wino in that place who couldn't get sober for many years, and that guy saved my life because he said, kid, give yourself a chance because you have an opportunity for a good life. And I can tell you today, 34 years later, I have a good life because of AA. I just recently retired. I'm from New Jersey. I just recently retired from a job for 38 years. And for 34 years, they want to get rid of me. You know, they want to get rid of me. And I got up and, you know, my retirement thing, I got up and gave a speech. And the one thing I kept telling my sponsor for the last 6 months was, I'm leaving here with dignity and respect. And I can tell you that at the end of my drinking, Milton had a styrofoam cup waiting for me at my locker of vodka. And I can tell you that I couldn't remember what I did Before I left work the day before, okay, he's telling me to stop. I can tell you that I love AA, and I do need people. You know, there used to be a guy in my group that used to say that song, People Who Need People, and I can tell you that I can't stay sober on my steam. I need you people. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Go ahead and come up. Him and then you. Yep. Hang on. We'll come right over to you. Got two in front of you.
My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. Uh-huh. My sobriety date, September 14th, 1997. My home group's a place called the Marina Center out on the west side of Los Angeles. My sponsor is a guy named Bill Cleveland. I love Bill. We're involved in one of the great bromances of all time. I absolutely love my sponsor. You know, I had an experience with all 12 steps my first year, and I love the story Terry shared. I had a lot of those experiences where people just appeared before me. And I was able to make amends. One of the difficult amends I made was, as a kid, I assaulted my sister, and it was hard to go back. But I just blundered forth when I was new, and I actually had a conversation with her. And she lives in a small town called Liberty, North Carolina, outside Greensboro. And I'd been there once. I helped her move there to make that move. I was in a moving storage business for a long time. I helped pack her up and send her off. She has a good job in that area. I visited her once. I'm the only one in the family that visited her there. When I was there, I helped her do some things. I showed up on her doorstep last week because I figured if I'm coming to Atlanta, I might as well go to North Carolina. And I showed up there, and lo and behold, in a tiny little town, she managed to get a roommate that was a crack cocaine addict. And one of the many things I did as an alcoholic, which I'm sure hasn't happened to anybody in this room this morning, is I managed to get addicted to narcotics. And I had borrowed a girlfriend's car over 20 years ago, drove out, was copping, guy busted the windshield. I show up in North Carolina. This guy had borrowed her car and a connection or somebody on the street busted her windshield. So I knew I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And I took her down to the windshield shop, and we put a new windshield in her car. Because that woman that I had busted her car, I wasn't able to do that then. And I wasn't able to do much either. And I got sober, and she wouldn't see me, and I was not able to make a face-to-face amends to her. But I had the opportunity to put a windshield in her car, do a bunch of other things for her. And as strange as it may sound, coming here, this is my fourth international, coming here to the international has been anticlimactic compared to the last 4 or 5 days I spent with my sister. And I'm not going to change my sister. I was just there to help her. You know, when I was new, I thought the 12 steps, you start at 1, you end at 12, and you're done. Well, I realized the triangle is surrounded by a circle, and the circle is the symbol of eternal life. There's no beginning, and there's no end. And the depth of understanding of the steps and the experience gets better and better and better and deeper and more meaningful as the years go by. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just a reminder, the topic is being willing to go to any lengths. Just a good reminder of what our topic is. Please, sir, you're next. Come to you after I go to the guy in red. Yep, we got time for a few more. I know we're losing folks, so please.
Hi, my name is Tom R. from Madison, Wisconsin. And the Fellowship of AA. And guys, my higher power. I've been sober since Easter of 2014, so about 14 months. So I'm ecstatic. And it's just so great to be here. I mean, my MO, I first got introduced and involved in the program back in 87. And I'm one of these relapsers. I've had probably 4 relapses over the course of that time. Built up some good sobriety, yeah, but then it eventually led back to a relapse. But you know, I never really truly, you know, I built up one time 13 years and went back out, 5 years went back out. And the MO was always the same. I would have 80% of my sobriety time was working up a good program, not a great program. And then the next percentage was staying sober but not working the program, and then eventually go back out and drink. And, you know, as I look back, and I can't believe it, I don't know how cunning and powerful and badly this disease is. My life was so good when I was sober working the program. It's hard to believe that I would give that up to go back out drinking or not working the program. On Easter Sunday of 2014, I'd become a daily vodka drinker. I live alone. I used to hide vodka in my house. I always felt that, you know, I was married once before a divorce of over 20 years, but I was also married a second time. That was that bottle of vodka. And I got a little bigger over time, but that bottle got bigger as well during that time. So eventually it just took me and just ate me alive. I didn't care if I was to die. I wasn't suicidal, but I was an alcoholic, and that's what I'm supposed to be doing. So I continued drinking. I'll die drinking. But, you know, I had a spiritual awakening on Easter Sunday. Went to the hospital, went up to a treatment program in Minnesota from that. And life has just been great today. It's been super. I attribute it to a couple of things. I've always been a Christian. When I've been involved in the program in the past, I never really worked the program. But this time around, I do things. I work my sobriety one day at a time. I work on all those character defects. And I turn my life over to God. To me, alcoholism is 10% alcohol and 90% the ism. Living life one day at a time at your best ability. I have a very difficult time managing my life. And today I just take it simple. I slow down and I ask for help and pray at the end of the night and review the date and then start the next day. Sure.
Gentleman in red over here and then the woman here in blue and then we'll be wrapping it up. Come on down. Oh. My bad. I will make that right. Thank you. We have three more. Yep, please.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brian.
Hey, Brian.
My sobriety date is March 9th, 1975. And I met a lady on Thursday, as down where you get these things. And, her sobriety date was March 10th, 1975. And so these little God incidences happen all the time when you're sober. And so going to any lengths, 1969 in Connecticut, we had, the El Grasso Blizzard. And the El Grasso Blizzard, closed down all the interstates and everything else, ended up stranded in Meriden at a Holiday Inn, sleeping on the floor of the Holiday Inn, the ballroom, and more a matter of passing out. There was a party going on, but they said you can't get in if you don't have any booze, and we didn't have any booze. So there was a gentleman who heard the sorrow story that I couldn't get into the party. And so he said, if you go down to our car, which is in the snowbank about 2 miles down, you know, and it was still snowing like crazy. The wind was blowing. It was a real nor'easter snowstorm. So he gives me a note to his wife, and there was two wives there, and walked down, and my buddy and I, we walked down through the blizzard and found the car. The ladies gave us the key to the trunk, and it said grab one bottle. But we couldn't do that. We needed to get into the party. And so we grabbed a couple of bottles, a bottle of scotch and a bottle of gin, and trekked back through this blizzard. And so we got into the party.
Really?
6 years later, I'm sober 3 years. There's another blizzard. and I drove down to the AA meeting.
Thank you very much. The gentleman I overlooked, and then we'll close with the woman in blue. Please come on down. For those I'm offending by these hard stops that says stop, that's out of regard for the audience, and so I apologize for those that I'm offending with that.
I'm George. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
My sobriety date is February 24th, 1974. I'm a product of the 90-day program, this process. I was about 93 days sober, and I went to work one morning, and this guy was drinking. Prior to that, I had been the happiest guy in the world. No cares, nothing. I'm laughing, and I'm enjoying this feeling of not having to drink. And when I saw this guy drinking, I lost it. I lost that feeling. And I didn't know what happened, so I came back to my home group that night, and I was asking him about what happened to me. And he said, well, he said, George, you have a resent. He said, you resent that guy. And I said, I don't resent what people do. He said, yes, you do. He said, I said, well, why do I resent him? He said, because he can drink and you can't. And I said, well, I resent a lot of people. But what I was going to do that weekend, I was going out to my neighborhood and I was going to get drunk. Because I was going to kick the program. I had failed it. And I went to my neighborhood, and I looked down at these guys, and they were sitting there, and they was drinking, or either waking up from a drink. And I said, well, no, I'll wait till Saturday morning. And Saturday morning, I came back to the same place, and some of the same guys were sitting there. And I said, well, I'll try it. And I walked over to the counter, and I wanted to ask the lady for my favorite drink, which was a bottle of Wild Russian Bunya, and I couldn't do it. And I wanted to know why. Why I couldn't ask for my favorite wine. So that night I didn't go to a meeting. I stayed at home. Few people called me, but on Sunday morning we would go out to the federal penitentiary, and I went out to that meeting and I came back. And what really puzzles me is that I didn't know why I couldn't drink. What happened with my desire to drink? And so I had been reading this book called Sobriety and Beyond. And I finally turned a page over, and it told me something that I had written out of that book. It said, we can put it down as an indisputable fact that one who humbly and sincerely prays daily for strength and guidance will not slip. The good Lord would not let him. I did not know until that moment that my desire to drink had been removed. Thank you.
Thank you. That was like 2 minutes and 40 seconds. He nailed it. Come on up. It's like that's a sense of time. Yep.
My name is Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barbara.
My sobriety date, September 16th, 1983. Gloria is my sponsor. And I just wanted to share that my first year and a half here, I got here on a court card. I was a daily drinker, blackout drinker, pee on myself drinker, bar drinker, everything. And I got here on a court card and on a date. Anyway, so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I raised my hand in my second meeting because I heard something. I heard hope. Gloria always asked me, where was she? And my first year and a half, I ran around here, ran my own program. I had sponsors, but I got to do what I wanted to do. I thought I knew stuff. At a year and a half, my back was up against the wall. Gloria came into my life. Thanks to Alex, she moved into our neighborhood, and I was willing to go to any lengths, you know. And when she became my sponsor, she asked me, she says, are you willing to go to any lengths? I said, yes, and I was. I was tired of doing it my way, and I was miserable. So, like she said, she's been my sponsor since 1985, and I'm still willing to go to any lengths. I still listen to her direction. Sometimes I think, you know, I've been here around, you know, a little bit too, and, you know, what does she know? But she knows. You know, and like I'm still willing to go to any lengths, and that's why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.